This is a Triple J podcast.
Hack. Hey, it's Dave Marchese. This is the Hack Podcast. We hear a lot about meth, whether it's news coverage about drug busts, the impact it has on communities, violence ripping families apart. But how much do you know about the history of this devastating drug? You know, if you've ever used it, maybe you understand a bit more about it. If you've had someone in your family who's been caught by meth, been caught up in it and had some devastating experiences, it is now the second most consumed illicit substance in Australia. So a lot of people are using it. In a bit, we're going to get into the research into drug use in Australia that reveals some stuff about our habits here, but also we're going to talk specifically about meth and how it's become so popular in Australia, but also in New Zealand. We've got someone on the line from New Zealand who's been researching this, and there are some parallels in our history with this drug. Later, we're going to explore the life of one of the world's most powerful but most secretive people. Like, he leads a country, is popular beyond belief. Everything he touches goes viral, but somehow managed to hide that he had a wife for decades. We'll fill you in. First, though.
Hack. The Romanian court has granted a request by British authorities to extradite Andrew Tate and his brother
on Triple J.
Yeah, Andrew Tate is back in the headlines. The self-proclaimed misogynist with millions of followers around the world was in court overnight in Romania with his brother. You might know they've been in Romania for a while, where they're awaiting a trial on allegations of rape, human trafficking, and forming a criminal gang to sexually exploit women. But Andrew Tate and his brother were actually arrested a few days ago and could now be facing extradition to the UK over new offences. So what has happened? With an update, here's April McLennan.
So what happens is, when you get to a certain level of fame, they go through your entire life forensically and try and destroy you. And what have they found on us? Some old YouTube videos that we published ourselves.
This is the moment Andrew Tate and his brother Tristan were detained by Romanian police.
I called supposedly my ex-girlfriend's a slave once on a WhatsApp chat. That's it.
In 2012, there's no perversion, nothing untoward. What have they found on us? Here we are 2 years into this process. You don't see any girls with bruises. You don't see any. Where's the victims of all this?
The whole thing
is garbage.
The following day, video footage shows a police van pulling up outside a Romanian court. The doors swing open and the handcuffed brothers are led inside.
Andrew, are you ready to go back to London?
Why do you think they reopened the case?
So what sparked all this? Well, the men are facing fresh allegations of sexual aggression in the UK between 2012 and 2015. And because of this, they're facing an extradition order issued by the British government and now granted by the Romanian court. It means the Tate brothers can be sent back to the UK to face these new criminal charges, but only after legal proceedings against them have played out in Romania. Here's what Andrew and Tristan Tate's lawyer had to say outside court.
As far as we know, this investigation was already closed. We don't know if this investigation is reopened, if there is any new evidence submitted by the authorities. There are only legal suppositions.
It's fair to say Andrew Tate is a controversial figure online. He's an influencer with nearly 9 million followers on X, who's known for his extreme views towards women. He also describes himself as absolutely a misogynist. And when you hear some of the things he says, he has a point. Stuff like this.
I do know how to administer CPR. However, I will not administer CPR unless you're a hot female.
Life for a man is harder than life for a woman. We need to have a lot of shit to be an important man. To be a woman, you need makeup.
Last year, the Tate brothers, along with two Romanian women, were indicted in Romania for human trafficking, rape, and forming a criminal gang to exploit women. They deny the charges. But now there's this extradition ruling. Here's what Andrew Tate had to say outside court.
No, we're very innocent men, and in time, everybody's going to see that, and we're very excited to finish this judicial process and clear our names.
The UK police say their charges stem from an investigation into allegations of rape and human trafficking.
This is what appears to be a totally new allegation or set of allegations that has led to the first UK arrest warrant around the Tate brothers. This arrest warrant was issued by the Bedfordshire police. This is according to the National Crime Agency.
That's Matt Shea. He's an author and investigative reporter who's across what's happening with the Tate brothers. And Matt says there's one main reason why authorities chose to pursue the UK arrest warrant now.
At least according to the lawyers of four women involved in the civil case against Andrew Tate, because there was a rumour he was going to flee the country.
The Tate brothers had actually been under house arrest in Romania, but they've now been released from custody. They'll remain under what's called judicial control in Romania. Basically, that means they can't leave the country. But it's not yet known when their trial in Romania can actually start, because the courts there are pretty backlogged. In the meantime, over on X, Andrew Tate is claiming he's now been under some form of arrest for 440 days and is comparing himself to Julian Assange.
You're listening to Hack on Triple J.
Yeah, April McLennan with that update. We'll keep you across what is going on with all of this court stuff in Romania, any other developments that are happening with Andrew Tate, his brother. We'll make sure we keep you informed.
Hack.
Drug use in Australia is on the rise.
On Triple J.
Yeah, I don't know if this surprises you, but the use of illicit drugs like meth, cocaine, MDMA is on the rise. And we've spoken about drug use figures recently on Hack. We do it often, and that's because a couple of times a year, the Australian Criminal Intelligence Agency tests sewerage water for legal and illicit drugs. So it gives them a bit of an indication of what is going on in the community. The most recent report is out, and it's found a sharp increase in the use of some illicit drugs, and the findings are especially interesting if you live outside the major cities. Shalila Madora explains.
When people take drugs, they then go to the toilet, and basically the wastewater from that is collected at a treatment plant. Now, before it goes into the treatment plant, it's sampled.
Shane Nielsen works for the Australian Criminal Intelligence Commission. It's a law enforcement body whose job is to investigate organised crime in Australia. For the last 7 years, the commission has been testing wastewater for both legal and illicit drugs.
It's designed to make sure that people across the country and in government departments understand what's happening with the consumption of drugs.
The most recent report found that booze, vapes and ciggies are still very popular.
Unsurprisingly, consumption of nicotine and alcohol is far higher than the illicit drugs. It's always been that way. It always will be that way.
But this year, alcohol consumption in the regions fell to an all-time low. And that's not the only surprising finding. The use of methamphetamines, as well as cocaine and MDMA, is up significantly.
That was a 17% increase in that 12-month period.
Meth consumption has jumped by 17% across the country, but the jump is much higher in places like Western Australia at 40% and Tasmania at 36%. It's gone up in both regional areas and the capital cities, with regional New South Wales recording the highest per capita use.
85% of the money that's spent on illicit drugs in Australia is spent on methamphetamine, so $10.5 billion we estimated, which is an extraordinary amount of money.
While there's been a jump since the last report in use of MDMA, it still remains at near historic lows.
The meth market has just swallowed up whole bunches of the other illicit stimulant market, and that MDMA has not come back because organised crime groups are taking the view they'd rather send meth to this country rather than send MDMA.
The report tested 62 sewerage sites across the country, and it found where you live plays a big role.
The majority of the substances we measure, and this is per capita, consumption in regional areas is higher than in the city.
Shane Nielsen says there are differences between the major cities and regional areas when it comes to the popularity of certain drugs.
Drugs like heroin and cocaine, they're consumed on average far less in regional areas. And this is where methamphetamine just dominates everything else along with cannabis, is that they are available in regional areas as well as the capital city. And that's why their consumption level is so much higher.
Hack on Triple J.
Shalila Madora with that update. A lot of comments on Instagram. Hack's Instagram, someone says, bloody hell, that's a lot of meth. Someone else, Brett, says meth contaminates a lot of drugs these days. That could be the reason for the jump as well. And someone else says beer over gear any day of the week. Well, let's find out a bit more about this drug in particular, about meth. And someone who's been looking into this is Benedict Collins, a journalist in New Zealand who wrote a book about meth called Mad on Meth, about how New Zealand got hooked on the drug. It's interesting because there are parallels here with Australia's history with meth too. Benedict, thank you very much for coming on Hack. We've just heard that meth use is up in Australia, the second most used illicit substance in Australia after cannabis. You've been looking into the history of meth use in New Zealand. What have you found?
It wasn't that long ago that methamphetamine was actually legal in New Zealand, and it was sort of widely prescribed, particularly as a weight loss drug for women in the 50s and 60s. And then in the early 1970s, it was banned in New Zealand. And it kind of disappeared out of public sight. And then in the early 2000s, that was when, like, basically people figured out how to start cooking methamphetamine in their kitchens and their garages and stuff like that, mainly with cold medicine that had pseudoephedrine in it. And they could take the pseudoephedrine out of the cold medicine and make really powerful methamphetamine. So we had a really big problem in the early 2000s. Thousands of people cooking methamphetamine themselves, and then lots of people getting hooked on it, you know, and having really disastrous consequences in their lives. 10 years later, it kind of backed off a little bit. And now we kind of have, I think it's pretty similar to Australia, we have kind of around 1% of our population using methamphetamine every year. But the vast majority of that 1%, they'll only use it a couple of times. When you talk about people who have, you know, who are really hooked on meth, talking about a smaller group of people again.
It's wild to think that decades ago people had regular access to this drug. You said it was used as a weight loss drug. People could just go and pick it up if they wanted it.
Yeah, right. You could go to your chemist and get methamphetamine to help you lose weight. And not just meth, but speed or amphetamines as well. In my book, actually, I talk about there was an Australian swimming competition where just about every swimmer there was taking like amphetamine pills that they got at their chemist to help them break records. There were like cycling championships in New Zealand where they reckon just about every cyclist was either, you know, taking a methamphetamine or a speed pill to, you know, help them get going and help them smash records. In 1965, I think it was, our Civil Aviation Authority warned pilots against taking too many amphetamine or methamphetamine pills, which they call PEP pills, before they flew because it could make them dangerously overconfident. You know, it's kind of remarkable now. There were also stories about like pianists trying to set world records for how long you could play the piano. And journalists would say, oh, yes, they've been popping amphetamine pills for the last couple of days as they try to break these records. You know, people didn't really bat an eyelid at the use of amphetamines and methamphetamine pills, I think, to a bit of a lesser extent back in the, you know, 50s and 60s.
Yeah, the history is fascinating and goes all the way through World War II, I think. There's also references to amphetamine use then. Can you paint a picture of how big of a problem meth use has been in New Zealand in recent times? Because obviously we get a very big picture, good indication of what it's like here. We know in regional communities in Australia it's been a particularly huge problem. There have been inquiries into it, politicians trying to figure out what to do about it. What's been the issues in New Zealand?
In the early 2000s, when it was really problematic, and it kind of came out of nowhere to a certain degree, like it had been banned for a couple of decades and people hadn't really seen it. We had some like horrific crimes that were committed here. And in response, the government banned pseudoephedrine from cold and flu medications. And what we saw was basically that did have quite an impact on the domestic manufacturing of methamphetamine. And countries all around the world really cracked down on pseudoephedrine because it was just so easy to turn it into meth. Really cracked down. It was always kind of a bikey gang thing. And then it kind of became more mainstream. But what we've seen, and I imagine it's probably the same in Australia, we've got gangs now, they're really tapped in to like these international methamphetamine markets. They're well connected with people who are cooking it, and they're bringing it in via the ton now into New Zealand. And I understand huge amounts are also coming into Australia as well. So kind of once our government's decided to ban it and outlaw it, you know, your illegal motorcycle gangs, your outlaw gangs kind of seized the day, so to speak, and took control of this drug, which, you know, is undoubtedly problematic. And then what we had is like the global meth trade just really evolved. what you have now is you've got in Mexico, you've got the cartels cooking meth. And when I'm talking about them cooking meth, they can like produce a couple of tons of methamphetamine a day. And in Myanmar as well, up in Southeast Asia, up in the Golden Triangle, they're just churning out so much methamphetamine. It's incredible. And every year, records are just being smashed.
You're listening to Hack. I'm Dave Marchese, speaking with author, journalist Benedict Collins about his book Mad on Meth, chronicling New Zealand's battle with the drug ICE, the parallels with Australia, some of the history, the global supply chain. Benedict, as you say, you've been looking into the manufacturing process overseas, the huge global meth market that sprung up to satisfy this massive demand worldwide for it. What did these global officials tell you when you spoke to them about how hard it is to keep track of what is going on?
So I spoke to a United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime expert up in Bangkok, and he was talking to me about what's happening in Southeast Asia with methamphetamine. And it wasn't that long ago in Southeast Asia, most people were into opium. And he was saying in the last 10 years, it's just flipped completely. And all these countries across Southeast Asia have just become massive methamphetamine markets. And that they consume methamphetamine a little bit differently up there as we do in Australia and New Zealand. They kind of take these really cheap Yaba pills, and they might cost like 50 cents US per pill. And it's about 20% methamphetamine, and the rest is kind of like caffeine and stuff like that. Methamphetamine use in Southeast Asia is just rampant.
Was there anything particularly surprising you found while researching this book?
I found a few things that were really interesting. One was there was actually a little village in China called Bosch Village. And this village of 20, 30,000 people was basically became a methamphetamine village. And on multiple occasions, the Chinese police tried to raid this village in China, which was producing huge amounts of methamphetamine. And every time the Chinese police came and tried to sort of invade this village, they got ran out of town by villagers who would like blockade the village with their motorbikes and threaten the police. And then it wasn't until they basically launched this enormous operation against this village, where they brought in like sort of out of town police from all over China, military police, you know, heavily armed, that they actually managed to get control of this methamphetamine-orientated village in China.
Fascinating stuff, and your book is really interesting as well. It's called Mad on Meth. It's available now. Benedict Collins, thank you very much for joining us on Hack.
Oh, thanks very much for having me.
We've got some messages coming through. Jenny says, we need to address the fact that medicinal cannabis is now legal, and heaps of people are now accessing cannabis products that never used them when they were illegal. Erica from Kulin Nation says, as somebody with ADHD, prescribed amphetamines saved my life. And someone else says, I was prescribed methamphetamines on an ocean research vessel for extreme seasickness, and it was the only thing that worked. It's really interesting. Also remember, you know, the National Alcohol and Other Drug Hotline is a 24/7 service that can provide you with free and confidential advice. If you're struggling, if you might need some support, you can find it by calling them on 1-800-250-015.
Hack! The Indian elections, at the end of the day, the greatest show on earth.
On Triple J.
Yeah, in a couple of months, the largest elections in history are going to take place in India. More than 900 million people will cast their votes over 6 weeks. And a lot of them will be young people, because more than half of India's population is under the age of 30. Now, India's Prime Minister, Narendra Modi, is expected to easily hang on to power, be re-elected. He is one of the most powerful people in the world. But his own private life is pretty mysterious, like how he kept his marriage secret for decades. It's really interesting stuff. And the ABC's South Asia correspondent, also your former host here at Hack, Avani Dias, has been digging into it. She's got a new podcast out called Looking for Modi, and she's been tracking down people who grew up with him, who have known him for years, finding out about his past. And Av's back with us now. G'day, Av. Welcome back to Hack.
Hey, Dave.
Just how powerful is Narendra Modi in India and around the world? Paint a picture of how much influence this leader has?
So, Dave, India is firstly the world's most populous country. 1.4 billion people live here. So imagine being the leader of that many people. But now India's become this really influential player around the world. It's competing with countries like China and America to become a world superpower. And everyone wants to sort of get close to India. But in terms of popularity, Narendra Modi is just huge. He has the biggest social media following of any world leader. The last couple of years that I've been reporting here as a South Asia correspondent in India, what I've found is that Modi is just so popular that he feels like he's untouchable now. Like, it's really hard as a journalist here to cover him, to cover his backstory.
Av, that's so interesting about, you know, how the media covers Modi. Maybe the fear that some journalists have in reporting the wrong thing. Is it something that you feel as a journalist there every day? Because you're based in Delhi. You work for the ABC. So you're an Australian journalist working for an Australian group. But do you still feel the pressure?
Totally. And it's been a bit of a shock, to be honest, right? Because before this job, I was working for Hack and we had the freedom to cover what we wanted. And obviously you get sort of criticism and backlash and so on, but that's just part of what we do as journalists. But here in India, it's a whole different ballgame. So for example, last year when Anthony Albanese, the Australian Prime Minister, came to India, he was trying to build closer relations with Narendra Modi, and me and a bunch of other journalists from Australia were traveling around with the leaders around India. But then this weird thing happened one day where one of the Australian journalists decided to ask Narendra Modi a question. We were at a cricket stadium in Gujarat in the west of India, and he asked him some pretty basic question. He was just like, oh, what do you think about relations between our two countries in cricket? And, you know, that's a pretty easy question to answer. But Modi got so awkward. He stumbled out this really awkward answer. It didn't really make sense. And then afterwards, all of us in that group of journalists were told off. We were told we can't ask questions of Modi. And I knew that as someone who's lived here for the last couple of years. But it's crazy to think about. And I know some people listening might be like, well, that's India. You know, there's no way you could ask people questions if they're in power. But that's not true. Before Narendra Modi, this has been a more open place for the press, a more open place for democracy and to question leaders. So it's definitely been a lot of pressure working here.
That's so interesting and really paints a picture of what it's like day to day. I want to get back into this deep dive that you've done into Narendra Modi with the podcast. You've been investigating his links with a far-right organisation in India. What is that all about?
Yeah, Dave, this is a really interesting part of Narendra Modi's backstory, because in India, there's a group called the RSS, and it's believed to be the largest far-right organisation in the world. It's got 6 million members. And Narendra Modi actually joined this organisation when he was 8 years old. He was just a tiny little kid living in a village in the west of India. And he got recruited by this organisation because they have 68,000 branches across the country. And they have these daily meetings, but they're more like camps. So they run for an hour every morning. Members do martial arts. They do tug of war. They do these fighting exercises. I went to one of these meetings. I got rare access and I saw all of this happening in front of me. And then they chant things about how much they love India and the Hindu religion. And India is a secular country, so that means that it's meant to be open to all religions. It is majority Hindu, but there are hundreds of millions of people here who follow Islam, Christianity, Sikhism, and so on. And the RSS, this organization, believes that India shouldn't be secular, that it should be only Hindu, and that if you're of another religion in this country, you should accept that fact. And so, you know, on one hand, the RSS, with its millions of members, they do charity work, they helped out during COVID and so on, but they've also been accused of violence and triggering riots here in India. So what I've looked into in this first episode of the podcast is how these meetings work. It was pretty crazy to see how they function day to day and what Modi would have been doing, because for decades he dedicated himself to this organisation. But researchers also say that as leader, Narendra Modi has been enacting and putting in policies which put forward this idea that India should be a Hindu-first country, not a secular one.
You're listening to Hack. I'm Dave Marchese. I'm speaking with ABC foreign correspondent Avani Dias about India's leader Narendra Modi and a new investigation that she's been leading into who he is, his backstory. There's a podcast called Looking for Modi that's diving into all of this. Av, one of the wild things in the podcast is the story of Modi's secret wife, and you went on this trip to find out more about her. Who is this woman and why nobody has known much about her in the past? What did you find?
You know, when you watch the news or see things on social media, you see world leaders, male world leaders, often coming out with their partners or their kids. I mean, think about Anthony Albanese and Jodie Hayden. They just got engaged and he was talking about that. They're together everywhere at world events and so on. Scott and Jenny Morrison. But here in India, it's actually kind of a badge of honour to be single because it shows that you're dedicating your entire life to the country, that you don't care about anything else. You don't have these family connections. That's all you care about. So Narendra Modi took on that whole persona. He, for decades in politics, as he was rising up through the ranks, he was saying, I'm single. I'm dedicating everything to this country and nothing else. But then 10 years ago, when he first ran for prime minister in 2014, it came out he had this secret wife. So I've been looking into this and it's so interesting. Basically, when he was a toddler, when he was three, his family set him up with another child to be married. They didn't get married at that stage and they had to wait till they were teenagers. So it was an arranged marriage. But when they were about 15, 16, they got engaged. And then when they were 17, 18, they actually got married. But then Narendra Modi was like, I'm leaving. I'm going to go find myself in the Himalayas in the north of India. And he said he wanted to go and try and become a monk. And he left his arranged marriage and his wife. And he said, look, you can stay here. You can live with my family, but I'm going to go. I want to go do my own thing. He has kept this wife a secret. He's actually gone to huge lengths with his staff to keep this a secret, but it did come out. But he still refuses to talk about it. So I went to go and find this woman in his village in Gujarat. And look, we got pretty close and you'll hear it on the podcast as well. But me and my producer, Som, we ended up getting onto her brother, who she now lives with.
What do you reckon the most surprising thing you found doing this was?
I think there are many elements about it. I think the fact that Modi has a secret wife, I mean, how do you keep a first lady a secret? That is just crazy. I feel like the fact that Narendra Modi, this powerful leader that a lot of people would have heard about, obviously, tried to become a monk. So at first he just wanted to get the robes on and become a Hindu monk, which is really interesting. And I think what was crazy was when I went to his hometown, I ended up randomly at the wedding of his nephew.
What?
Yeah, just at the hotel we were staying at. And it was this low-key event. And in India, where weddings are this lavish affair, like Rihanna played at this wedding last week. And the weird thing was that Narendra Modi never showed up. And that's quite strange in India, which is a country where everyone goes to weddings, especially if it's your nephew's wedding. And what I found out is that Narendra Modi is pretty estranged from his family. He doesn't talk to his siblings. He only really spoke to his mum and she passed away a couple of years ago.
The podcast is incredible. It's called Looking for Modi. The first episode's out now. You can catch it on ABC Listen, wherever you get your podcasts. ABC South Asia correspondent Avani Dias, thank you so much for breaking it all down for us.
Thanks so much, Dave.
Hack on Triple J.
And that is all we've got time for on the Hack Podcast for now. I'll be back next time. I'll catch you then. See ya.